That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.
You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, noon Auckland. Welcome along to the Tuesday Wire for the 5th of February. I honestly can't believe it's already February. It still feels like it's New Year's, so that's kind of weird. Ko Stuart Soman, lan toku ingoa. It's good to be back. I'm sure everything went to plan with Lillian last week, but it's nice to be back here, kind of knowing what's going on the show. Joining me in studio today, my producers Liv and Lisa. Finally, we're all together. How are you two going?
Good.
Yeah, pretty good.
Sorry I wasn't there for so long.
It's okay. It's okay. I was away last week. We're all, look, it's all our fault, yes, collaboratively.
We made it.
Have you got any plans for Waitangi Day?
Writing an economics essay.
That's going to be great.
Yeah.
I'm down in Wellington and the weather forecast is not for sun, and I feel like it's a waste of my time to go all the way home.
Escaping the heat wave.
I'm like, I don't want sun, I want rain. Coming up on the show today, calls for New Zealanders to learn more about our colonial past in schools. The chair of the History Teachers Association joins me. Plus, should New Zealand just outright ban cigarettes? It's being proposed in Hawaii. ASH spokesperson Ben Uden speaks with me. Then our European correspondent Mary Margaret Slack is back for another week. There's always something to talk about in the UK. Plus, Green Desk is here as usual. This week, Mitchell talks to University of Canterbury Associate Professor of Engineering, Dr. Aaron Marshall, about his almost zero waste solution for treating acid waste and discarded zinc. Liv talks about the outcomes of the Australian Royal Commission's investigation into their financial sector and what this might mean for New Zealand. For our weekly international segment, Lisa reports on the latest developments of the political crisis in Venezuela. She'll also touch a bit on a potential deal between the United States and the Afghan Taliban. Now, as usual, I would love to hear what you have to say. Get in touch with any thoughts you have. I'd be really interested to hear what you have to say about smoking. I'm always a bit sceptical about a full ban. Do you think it would work? Plus, it's Waitangi Day. What does it mean for you? Do you think we need to learn more about our own past in schools? And what did you learn? Tuku patui mai, you can text me on 5395. Why am I? Call in on 309 3879 or tweet us at 95BFM News. Also, on our Twitter account today, we have our weekly poll. The question is, do you trust your bank? Please give me your thoughts. We'll be talking a little bit about that later on in the show.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Two for you New Zealanders have a sound understanding of what brought the Crown and Māori together in the 1840 Treaty, or of how the relationship played out over the following decades. That's what the New Zealand History Teachers Association think, and they've launched a petition calling for the House of Representatives to pass legislation that would make compulsory the coherent teaching of our own past across appropriate year levels in our schools. I spoke with the association's chair, Graham Ball, and started by asking him to explain his petition.
Well, it's a petition launched by the New Zealand History Teachers Association to call on the government to introduce, I suppose, a coherent framework by which all New Zealanders can be exposed to our colonial past, and that's, you know, roughly the 19th century, through their schooling. Now, where exactly that will occur and everything is something that can be sort of worked on after this kaupapa has been accepted in principle. But that's the issue at the moment, is getting the government to acknowledge that really we need a coherent strategy for the teaching of our own history to our young people.
Where do we stand at the moment? Because I feel like there are definitely aspects of our history that I learned really well, but there are parts that I had no idea about until I got to university. And I'm sure that for many people my age and older, that they'll have that same experience of learning bits and pieces. I mean, how is the system as it stands?
The system at the moment is essentially the guiding principle is luck. If you went to a school where for that school it was deemed important enough to teach aspects of New Zealand's colonial past, then they would have done it and probably done a good job. But it's very ad hoc. It is really left entirely up to departments and sometimes to individual teachers as to what they teach about our shared past, how much, how in depth, There is no guiding principle. So you can certainly emerge from school with a good understanding of New Zealand's colonial past. Equally, you can emerge and with either a patchy one or no particular real understanding at all. And that's the problem, really. There is no coherence. It's strange, really, for a nation, any nation, really, not to acknowledge and teach its own past. And we're a real outlier in that in terms of the countries that we like to compare ourselves to. So it's time to remedy this.
And why do you think this is how it's ended up? Do we know how did this actually happen?
I think if we go back decades, it's colonial cringe, you know, that real history was British history or certainly overseas history. When we moved through into more recent decades under the old Scolsi and UE systems, there was some attempt to do some New Zealand history, but again, it was very much optional. We did have at Year 13, once that sort of course came in, students could do, or schools and departments could choose to do either Tudor Stuart England, which the majority did, or 19th century New Zealand. Big schools could do both. So that's kind of where we're at. And once we got into NCEA, with all its advantages of a high autonomy curriculum where schools can be very responsive to the students in front of them, but there was, as part of that high autonomy, there was no prescribed content whatsoever, or context. All you have to do is explore certain sort of concepts, like, you know, events have complex causes and consequences and so on, which is great. It's really good, except there's, again, that there is no coherence in terms of what might be taught about New Zealand history, and conceivably you could pass through your schooling without being exposed to it at all, and that's simply not good enough.
Is it about teachers being interested in the subject as well?
I think the issue is a bit of a chicken and egg. If you've gone through schooling yourself and not really been exposed to New Zealand's history, and then you've gone through university and your teacher training not being exposed to New Zealand's history, and then you've gone into a department where they're not, you know, New Zealand history is not really being taught particularly, what will happen is that you will, A, have no expertise in 19th century New Zealand history or colonial history. So that's immediately a barrier to taking it on. And secondly, you will have expertise and develop more expertise in Tudor Stuart England or whatever other topics and contexts you might do. And once you've got that expertise and developed it and deepened it, you know, your teaching definitely improves the more familiar you become with the content. It's pretty hard to then turn away from that and take on something new, particularly if there's no real coherent set of resources out there to help transition from one context through to colonial New Zealand history. So I understand, and I don't have any animosity or whatever towards schools and departments where it's not happening, because there are really good reasons for that and understandable reasons for that. Having said that, I think it does take a certain amount of willingness and courage and determination, I guess, for some schools and departments to make the decision. But if we had a coherent strategy, that would certainly make it much easier, including resourcing and professional development. So, you know, we can go so far in our high autonomy model by ourselves, but I really do think that the government, the ministry, needs to step up here and take provide some of the framework by which we can do a coherent approach to our own past.
So how do we go about this? Is it some sort of kind of ground up revitalization, or do you just start it through secondary schools? Or it just seems like if you want to teach it properly, you'd need to start right from the bottom, and that might be a bit more complicated than just adding another paper to NCEA, for example.
Exactly. I think if we can convince the government and the ministry to accept this kaupapa, then we need to move to the next step of talking about what is the best way to implement that. NZHK has intentionally not talked about compulsion in its press releases and various things, because someone might have a better idea once we, you know, if we can get this sort of idea accepted, then when we start looking about how it could be implemented, someone might have a better idea than compulsion. Myself personally, I I don't know how we can do it without it, but as I say, maybe someone's got a great idea. You know, we can do a certain amount through NZHDA by encouraging teachers to include more colonial history in their programs, and we can try and provide resources. But I think really, if we're looking to have the sort of sea change that we're talking about here, that needs to be complemented, or at least that needs to be the groundswell, if you like, which I believe is building now, not just within the teaching community, but beyond it as well, to know our own history. That needs to be complemented by ministry policy as well and frameworks.
That was Graham Ball from the New Zealand History Teachers Association. It's an interesting discussion, interesting petition that they are raising here, because as I said in the interview, I think everyone in this country who went through the schooling system, whether it was School C or NCA, whatever program that you actually went through, you probably have a very different experience of what you actually learnt about New Zealand history. And so there probably does need to be some more comprehensive overview so that we all get a little bit more of the same understanding. I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on what you learned at school, or what you think needs to change about what we learn at school. Flick me a text 5395, or you can tweet us, of course, 95BFM News. It's time to take a quick break now on The Wire. Up next, we'll be talking Brexit with Mary Margaret Slack.
95BFM has been tearing it up since 1969. Woo-hoo! Nice. But we couldn't have done it alone.
Nope, we're still Auckland's best radio station thanks to generous people like you.
By signing up for a Simplicity B card, you help keep BFM alive, independent, and not shit. And as a thank you, you get sweet discounts from some of our mates.
Support independent media from as little as $4.20 a month. Nice. With a Simplicity B card. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words. Because he waka eke noa.
Te pahi, the boss.
Hey, can you look over this account for me, please? There's something weird up with it.
Sure thing. You're te pahi.
Springsteen is te pahi. I'm just a friend that gets paid more than you do.
Oh.
Te pahi, the boss.
Māori words, karawhiua. Give it a go.
Welcome back to The Wire. We've got producer Liv here in the studio at the moment. I want to know, what mic are you on? You're on that one.
Yep.
I want to know what you learnt about our history at school, and whether you learnt a bit of everything, or whether you feel like you missed out on quite a lot about our past.
Well, I mean, I know that I definitely started learning about the Treaty of Waitangi from primary school, but the kind of activities associated was design your own treaty for class.
Yeah.
So a little bit trivialised around the whole thing, and I do remember we'd do it every year, but very briefly, maybe for a week around this time of year. And it was, I can barely remember anything, just because it was, I think the culture around, at least at the schools and the way the teachers taught it, the ones which I had, was very kind of, oh, well, we have to do it again this year. Mm. And it was a kind of not, we didn't actually learn anything different any year, and nor was it actually gone into depth properly. So
yeah, I'd agree. I feel like I learned most of what I know about the treaty in particular when I came to university. I probably learned more about the American Constitution in high school than I did about our own treaty.
Yeah.
We had a text in response to that previous interview saying it's all very well in theory, but what version of history will be told? Isn't that kind of, it's a bit dumb, isn't it? There's only one version of history.
Well, no, that's the thing. That's the perspective.
That's what I mean. We need to learn history. Yep. We don't want to learn a perspective on it.
And
that probably is what we've been taught.
I would say
under the previous
taught
systems.
Yeah, I mean, I learned mostly from, because my sister was doing first year law, and she learnt a lot about it there.
And that's where I learnt most of it.
And I wasn't
as well
even doing law, but I learnt more from her telling me when she was studying about it than I did at high school or any of my schooling in New Zealand. So I think it's a big gap, which we actually do need to fill.
Yeah, I would totally agree. It's time now to head across the oceans. We're going to have our weekly catch-up with our European correspondent, Mary Margaret Slack, in the UK. This week, Theresa May is heading to Northern Ireland, and is a no deal off the table. Have a listen.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, it's outrageously hot and it's only 9 o'clock, but
can't relate.
Yeah.
Hey, happy Waitangi Day.
Well, for tomorrow.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. That fucks me up.
Just getting too prepared.
Yeah, way over here.
How was last week? How was Lillian?
it was really nice talking to her again. It's funny, like, hearing New Zealand accents now. I kind of relish every opportunity.
Really? So I personally find our accent kind of unbearable.
No, 100%. But then you listen back and you hear differences, I suppose. Like, I just used to think of it as so neutral, but now when I hear it, I'm like, oh, Jesus.
I mean, it's better than Australia.
That's true.
Now, I think we need to start with the classic question of what's actually happened in the last week, because just much always happens.
Always. So we're about 7 weeks out now from Brexit Day on the 29th of March, and we're getting closer and closer without having achieved anything, really. So it's Monday night here, and obviously the biggest debate of the week in the Commons is on Tuesday. So last Tuesday, there were some quite important amendments debated. One was Yvette Cooper's amendment, which would have acted sort of as a means to change blanking on the term here, but basically legislate to be able to extend Article 50 and prevent a no deal. But it did not go through, as many MPs feel that it would signal to the British public that they want to prevent Brexit altogether. But that's not what the Cooper Amendment was. I told Lillian last week when she was asking about it that it just gives Theresa May more time to negotiate. So that, even though the no deal risk that is, you know, as we've discussed previously, increasingly high, and the risk of it is widely disliked, even though it's disliked, majority of the MPs voted against that amendment, and they voted for the Prime Minister to renegotiate a deal that isn't actually up for renegotiation. So the saga of breaking this sort of
right
gridlock continues. Yeah.
So do we have any idea how close we are to another vote or a no deal or any of these things actually happening?
Well, the next thing that sort of happens is Theresa May honing in on the details within her draft agreement that are disliked and meant she faced defeat a couple of weeks ago in the first place. Now, one of these biggest issues is the issue of a backstop, which Theresa May supports, which would stop a hard border going up between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So tomorrow she goes to Northern Ireland to deliver a speech stressing her commitment to avoiding that hard border, because at the moment between those two areas, there's no barriers at all on trade and movement. But as soon as the UK leaves the European Union, Northern Ireland remains in the UK and the Republic of Ireland remains in the EU. And so the backstop that Theresa May has put forward is basically a measure to ensure that the no barrier regime remains intact so that none of the violence of the past is reignited. But it's highly disliked by certain MPs, most notably hard Brexiteers from the Conservative Party, who say that the only way forward is to remove a backstop. So a working group of Tories has been established now. The group is comprised of some who are pro-Remain and some who are pro-Leave, and they will be discussing the alternatives, of which there are three options. A trusted trader scheme, which essentially is just kind of the same thing that they have at the moment, avoiding the physical checks. There's also the option of having a mutual recognition agreement, which enables the Republic of Ireland to maintain their European Union's current rules. And the third option is basically the idea of employing new technology, which is quite a controversial one. It's not the core of the Brexit news at the moment, but when it is brought up, especially on talkback radio over here, it's quite a divisive issue. People think that parliamentarians are just sort of waving the term new technology around, even though none of the technology that is necessary really exists yet.
Right. And so when you talk about this border, I mean, it all sounds a bit Trumpy. Is it actually a similar sort of debate in terms of you know, or am I just being a bit inexperienced?
Well, it's definitely comparable to that sort of Trumpian border conversation in terms of its populist roots. However, it is more rooted in historical niches of the violence that took place. Ireland is a country that still very strongly feels the tensions of the past, and the border essentially would act as a physical reminder, a recognition of everything that fueled the fights that hurt so many in that nation. But the people, most notably Tories, who want to resurrect the hard border, do sort of fall in line with what you're identifying, that Trumpian kind of anti-immigration, nationalistic kind of rhetoric.
And what do people actually think about all this? What's the kind of commentary from the public at this stage?
On the Ireland issue, on the backstop issue?
Yeah.
The backstop one is definitely quite a jargon-filled thing. It's one of those things that every time you read about it, there's a lot of the stories here have attached to them, especially online, like dictionaries to help you with the jargon terms, and because a lot of the public sort of don't follow the exact details of terms like backstop and Cooper Amendment. So the backstop is definitely another one of those nitty-gritty details that is kind of overlooked. It's often a very oversimplified issue. I would say even sort of straw man arguments are drawn when it's discussed. So it's the issue of the Irish border is definitely something that isn't talked about here so much as it would be in Ireland, and it's more concentrated within discussions in Parliament, I would say.
Yeah, and I feel like that seems to be quite a common issue with Brexit, that there are so many different issues. They're all complicated, they all have their own nuances, and the public just have to try and understand as much as possible to actually form an opinion. And then, yeah, I feel like that's part of the issue as to why this has all happened in the first place.
Absolutely, and Lillian made that point to me last week as well. She was saying how when Brexit started, before they had even voted to leave, it was all pinned down to very, very simple terms, which, you know, very quickly the whole nation, I was going to say parliamentarians, but the whole nation has realised it's not simple at all. It's all tricky trade, and, I mean, the negotiations themselves just show how important the detail is at this point. So hopefully, I would like to see personally a little more discussion about issues of particularly the backstop in the public arena over here, because I don't know, that there it's a chance for England to sort of look at itself a little bit more closely and its presence in the world as a coloniser. So
yeah, well, we will keep watching it as we get ever closer to that March deadline. You're away the next 2 weeks, right?
I am, yes.
So we'll
I am going to be watching Rose Musfeo and Alice Theatre, the classic New Zealand comedians, performing at Soho Theatre.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I
keep hearing them promo it on their podcast.
Oh, yeah, they're so good, right? I love it.
Oh, cool. Well, next week and the week after we'll have Justin back, so we'll still have European discussion, so people won't go
Fantastic.
Without a couple of weeks talking about what's going on in that part of the world.
No, we wouldn't want to neglect that.
Of course not. All right, talk to you soon. Thank you.
See you, Stuart.
Bye. That was Mary Margaret. Honestly, every week it seems like there's something new, and I was saying this earlier in the newsroom. I was saying, maybe people will not be that interested in what's going on in the UK every single week, but I feel like it just is so different week on week, and I keep learning new things, Liv. What about you? Have you been... Do you follow it? Do you know what's going on?
I've been trying, but I'm not going to lie. It's definitely hard to keep up with.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because it's just a flood of different
stuff every week, and it's also mad.
Yeah. I think I'm just excited to see what actually happens when there's some concrete
evidence. Well, March is the supposed deadline. It just feels like since 2016, the UK and the US have both been just going along these insane paths.
Just very uncertain.
And then
I
Australia's
think.
Been crazy. I feel like we're just sitting here in our little part of the world watching what everyone else is doing and going, well, we're possibly a little bit better than you.
Yes, it's steering the, you know, lens away from New Zealand a bit, but we've always got our own problems to deal with.
Yes, that's true. I'm not going to say that we don't have our own problems to deal with.
The Wire.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Anyway, it is time now for The Green Desk with Mitchell Fuller.
Kia tau te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora. This is The Green Desk on 95BFM.
This week on The Green Desk, Mitchell talks to University of Canterbury Associate Professor of Engineering, Dr. Aaron Marshall, who along with his master's student Jonathan Ring has developed an award-winning almost zero waste solution for treating acid waste and discarded zinc from the galvanizing process. I don't really know what that means. You're going to find out very soon. Mitchell begins by asking Dr. Marshall a bit about the current galvanizing process, how the waste is produced and where it currently goes.
So at the moment, what they galvanizing is basically they just dip a piece of steel into molten zinc and it sort of just sticks to the outside of the steel. The problem is normally the bits of steel they want to galvanize already have a bit of rust and stuff like that on it. So what they do is they first dip those bits of steel into some acid to sort of clean them up before they put it into the zinc process. And it's that acid which is the waste from the galvanizing process. Eventually that acid sort of gets filled up with all this junk and they've got to dispose of it somehow. And it's really expensive to get rid of.
Okay, so how would your new process differ from this one?
Yep, so all it does is it takes the waste acid and treats it to recover the metals that are dissolved into it. So when they sort of clean these bits of steel, whole bunch of iron and other metals dissolve into the acid, and that's why they've got to throw it away eventually. Some of the metals dissolved in this acid are actually quite valuable. So, for example, the zinc in New Zealand, we throw away on the order of $500,000 worth of zinc a year.
And that's all in landfill?
Just, that goes straight into landfill.
Okay.
And zinc's considered essentially a toxic metal like lead. So that's what's expensive to get rid of because they have to be really careful of how they dispose it.
So with that $500,000, is there sort of a kilo weight for that? How much are we talking? I mean, it's all right if you can't quantify it. That's fine.
For example, in 1 ton of this waste, there'll be 150 kilograms of zinc in it. And we throw away about 100,000 tons of that waste a year.
Right. Okay. This goes straight to a landfill. Any landfill, or is there a specific one? Is there a specific one for this acid waste? Or
to be honest, I'm not sure. Waste sort of treatment companies come along, suck this stuff out of their tanks, then they normally neutralize it because it's strong acid, and that's kind of like thrown in, sort of like baking soda into it, and then they wait a long time, and you get this sort of horrible sludgy stuff. And then that goes into landfill. So in most cases, the landfill would have to be a special lined landfill to make sure that the zinc doesn't leach out into the groundwater and things like that.
So with this new process, what can it be repurposed for? So you said it heals the steel or?
No, so what it does is it takes the galvanizing process and all the steps that they currently use would remain exactly the same. All we do is take their waste, process it to extract the metals from it, so we recover the zinc and the iron that normally goes into landfill, and then the galvanizing companies can take that zinc and put it back into their zinc process, and we can also recover clean the acid a little bit so they can reuse the acid.
Right.
So our ultimate goal is to sort of essentially make it almost zero waste process. That's a little bit hard, but we sort of can get close to having no waste.
How close do you reckon you are at the moment?
At the moment, we end up with salty water.
All right.
So we can take that salty water and reprocess it to get back to our original chemicals that we have to put into the process, but that might not be economical. There's easier ways to deal with that. So at the moment, we expect we'll have to discharge salty water.
And so you said it's about 150 kilos per tonne. How much does that end up as a dollar value, like maybe annually?
So as a dollar value, that stuff is on the order of $500,000 a year.
Yeah.
So in New Zealand, this isn't, in New Zealand, we don't galvanize that much stuff. So, you know, $500,000 isn't a huge amount. But for example, there's, in New Zealand, there are 13 galvanizing companies. In China, there's 2,000 odd. So, you know, that the global amount is huge on this. And luckily, the good thing is that most galvanizing companies around the world are now realizing that the waste is pretty horrible. So they don't just see it as an economic problem. They sort of acknowledge the fact that, you know, they shouldn't be sort of discharging this horrible stuff, especially the zinc, where you could recover that and reuse it. So
definitely. So I see you've been given a grant, but where are you aiming to take this technology?
So our next step is we've got sort of developed the process in the lab. The next step is to build a pilot plant so that we can test it on site at a galvanizing factory in New Zealand.
Awesome.
So the idea is it'll probably process somewhere between a quarter and half of their waste at this stage. And then the way that we're actually building these or building this pilot plant, it's essentially a unit that can just sort of be stacked up. So then, you know, you might need two at one plant. If there's a bigger plant, you might need 10 of them. So once we've sort of got that working, our plan is to essentially start a business to sell these units.
That's awesome. That's about all the questions I've got. Did you want to add anything yourself?
No, it's just an exciting area to work in terms of trying to commercialise some interesting science, I guess.
That was Dr. Aaron Marshall speaking with our reporter Mitchell Fuller for The Green Desk. Now, Mitchell's been very helpful and has put together some figures after his conversation with Dr. Marshall. Not including the toxic acid waste, as a byproduct of the galvanising process, 15 tonnes of zinc goes into New Zealand landfills every year. This occurs across 13 New Zealand plants, which, if worked out on average, would produce 1.15 tonnes each. In China, there are approximately 2,000 plants, and if the average plant produced the same amount of steel as a New Zealand plant, they would see 2,300 tonnes of zinc going into landfills each year as a waste product. As a dollar value, Dr. Marshall estimates that New Zealand loses $500,000 to discarded zinc and that China loses $120 million in zinc to the current galvanizing process. Some interesting stuff there.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihei Modi Ora.
That was The Green Desk. We'll have another.
Traffic on the Western Motorway is it's pretty rough actually. Southbound this evening. Wow, really? Okay, avoid that one. Tristram Ave? No. Okay, well, traffic is maybe sit this one out, hey?
The 95 BFM traffic report every weekday on Breakfast and Drive, reminding you why it's better just to take the bus. The 95 BFM traffic report, thanks to Skybus Airport Express. Book online and save. Skybus.co.nz.
Ah, doesn't that salt on your skin feel so good? The enriching, invigorating freshness? We all come from the sea, you know.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Let's race out to the pontoon. I'm going to be young forever.
Where are you going? Ray, don't go outside in your Speedo.
The fish are my sisters.
7 a.m. swim. He kohui a te whetu karaka I te ata. With Spurba Dan. It's got life advice, culture and politics, philosophical musings, it's got features out the wazoo. The 7 a.m. swim, every Saturday morning, only on 95 BFM. Hi.
Welcome back. Just to kind of explain what happened there, I sort of forgot that it was meant to I was meant to set it to not go straight into the ads. So so that was the ads. And that was The Green Desk, another instalment for you next week. Time now for a report on the Australian Royal Commission into the financial sector. Liv, what you got for us?
So I reached out to some people this morning for comment on the outcome of the Commission's inquiry, but unfortunately no one was available for an interview. So I've done a brief roundup of the report and what it could be meaning for us in New Zealand. So in summary, the Australian Royal Commission released a report examining its financial sector, and this resulted in 76 recommendations spanning banking, workplace culture and financial advice to overhaul the entire industry. But the centrepiece of the report is the $850 million fees for no service scandal. Some of the parent banks of New Zealand's banks, including ANZ and Westpac, admitted to collecting fees from dead clients or clients that received no services. Other issues include charging clients for advice they never even received and firms lying to regulators. Australia's High Court Justice and Royal Commissioner Kenneth Hain says those responsible for misconduct in the financial services industries lie with senior management, so it kind of looks like the guys at the top might be facing criminal prosecution for this misconduct. So how will this be affecting New Zealand consumers and, most importantly, our trust in our banks? Well, last November, a banking sector report by the Financial Markets Authority and Reserve Bank found significant weaknesses in the way New Zealand banks govern and manage and conduct risks. And more recently, only last week, the FMA and RBNZ's report on life insurers revealed the sector in a very poor light, finding lack of focus on good consumer outcomes, so pretty much profits prioritised over people. Seems like the issues highlighted in the Australia Royal Commission are similar to the ones that we might be facing back at home, even though the behaviour is not as severe here. Minister of Finance Grant Robertson says the government will be looking closely at the recommendations of the Royal Commission to see whether they can be implemented here. But it does feel to me that the New Zealand sector needs to take action fast to show us that they actually deserve our trust.
Thank you very much for that. It's interesting. I didn't really know any of this. I don't really understand banks.
And that I think a lot of the majority of consumers as well, because as a bank customer, you're quite sticky. You don't really tend to look at your other options. You start with the bank and you stay there.
And that's something we're going to be talking about more in a sec. It's time now for our poll position.
Freedom of speech, it means you have to listen to me.
It's time to have your say. Poll position on The Wire.
Yes, it is time for poll position. Quite possibly my favourite segment of the week, because it's always fun to just talk about your uninformed opinions. This week, the poll was, do you trust your bank? We've had a tidal wave of responses coming into this poll question. 23 of you voted. Thank you very much. 39% say that 39% of you say that you do trust your bank. 61% no. I'd be interested in what both of you, Liv and Lisa's back in the studio. What do you two think? Do you trust your banks?
I mean, I think trust is a really difficult one, but in light of the recent inquiries, I'm not too sure when the majority of an outcome of working at a bank is just making money. So.
Yeah, I think I don't know if it's so much about trust, but it's not necessarily trust in the institution, but more in what the money that you give them is being used for rather than.
And we had a call in from a listener earlier who basically said that he's been with the same bank, he's been with BNZ his whole life, and it's kind of hard when you're in that cycle. What do you do? I mean, I'm obviously not that old, but I would like to think, but I've also pretty much been with BNZ my whole life, and I don't really feel like I understand enough about why I would change, what benefits there are. I just think I'll sit.
I think, it's quite interesting to think about as well. Obviously, you've got banks which have just dominated the financial industry for years. And then in the light of financial tech startups, we've got a lot of people, especially younger ones, actually willing to switch to these new tech startups which are offering different plans, saying, hey, we're more transparent with you guys, and they're actually more willing to give money than trust another bank. So I guess we can see how they're going to actually adjust in the face of tech. Mm.
And it would probably be interesting, there probably is statistics out there about how many people are with different banks, but do people actually care about ownership? I mean, why are less, I'm assuming less people are actually with Kiwi Bank than we may think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with Kiwi Bank and I seem okay with it.
I've got my Kiwi Saver,
I think. See, that Kiwi Saver, it's not actually a Kiwi Bank thing, which a lot of people I've actually spoken to, a lot of my peers think it is. it's meant to be for, obviously, you know, superannuation funds and buying your first house and all that.
Something we'll probably never do in Auckland.
I know. It's a dream. It's a dream. Maybe one day.
Just waiting till my parents die.
But yeah, it'd be nice to have a lot more.
That'll give me a deposit.
Financial education, I think.
Yeah, because I think that's the main thing as well is we probably ought to not be naive when it comes to banks because, you know, it's massive financial institutions that have an interest that is their own to begin with, I think, before it being our one. I mean, they're in the business to make money like everybody else. Exactly. So, you know, they're not just holding your money just like that to be nice.
Keeping with the sort of education theme we've got on the show, I mean, I feel like I didn't learn much about personal economics at school. You learn about economics maybe if you choose to do it, or maybe a bit in social studies or something, but you don't learn about
theoretical terms.
Exactly.
I think as well, which I don't know. I think we need to learn more.
We've had some other messages in about some of the other things that we've been talking about in terms of learning about New Zealand's past. Someone texted in to say that it seems like a waste of time as it only goes back to the 17th century. People were here thousands of years ago. That's from Grant. A little bit unsure about what that means. I'm guessing we were talking about this before.
History?
Yes. Do we go beyond just learning about the Treaty of Waitangi? Do we learn about earlier New Zealand history?
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
I think that would be quite important.
And someone called in to say that when they were at school, all their sort of exposure to our past was the school had a Māori cultural group. They didn't learn anything about it in class. And so it was sort of you had to opt in.
Mm. So opting into learning your country's history.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's
weird.
So I'm European. I come from France. And it seems really foreign to me, this concept of like your country started when this happened. Mm. I don't understand. It's like, because it wouldn't apply to me in France. When does it start? When we sort of start looking like what we look like today, that would be not that long ago. And then there'd be like centuries of history that would not be taught.
And
but
imagine,
then it's all intermingled. Like you're not just the end result of like this one event. There's so much more that happened before. So it seems really foreign to me that you would just decide that the white people came, that's when our history started.
That's pretty much how.
And imagine Americans deciding we're going to opt in to learn our history. You know, it's just such a weird concept that of people having to like decide I want to learn about our past rather than it being forced on you because everyone should theoretically know about their country. And someone just has texted in going back. I know we're just sort of flicking between subjects, but who cares? Someone's texted in about banks that saying you should be banking with New Zealand-owned banks. I think it's easier said than done for many people if you've been brought up a certain way, if you've been with a bank your whole life.
I think a lot of the time as well, it's your parents who set up your first bank account.
Yeah, exactly. You don't really get to choose.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. There's so many of them. You don't really know which one to choose from. So
do you choose a certain bank?
I chose based on whatever was the closest or the most convenient when I could get a meeting straight away and set it up like the fastest way possible. That's about it.
Like, what would make you switch? You know, you've got to think about those switching costs, and many people just don't have time or care enough.
Only people I know who change banks is credit card related to get like a better deal. That's about
and even then, you don't really
probably
necessarily
just have like
know
three different bank accounts.
Yeah. All right. We've gone over time, but who cares? It's fun just talking about stuff we don't really know about. That was Pole Position.
It's called Democracy, sweetie. Look it up.
That was Pole Position on The Wire.
All right, time to talk about New Zealand's smoke-free goal. New Zealand has for years been striving towards being smoke-free by 2025. That goal now seems almost unattainable, and yet the state of Hawaii is looking at moving towards an outright ban by 2024. A new bill calls for raising the cigarette buying age to 30 by next year. It's currently sitting at 21, which is already a fairly high age anyway. Then it will be up to 40, 50 and 60 in each subsequent year, and it will be up to 100 by 2024. Does that mean if you're over 100, you can still buy cigarettes? Well, good for the elderly. Ben Udan, a spokesman for ASH, tells me whether something like this would ever work in New Zealand.
New Zealand's got a goal to be smoke-free by 2025, and that's been around since 2011 when the Māori Affairs Select Committee said that was their aspiration for this country. So the intention for New Zealand to be smoke-free been around for quite a long time. I think the big difference is that Hawaii stood up and said, we're going to do it this way. By 2024, we're going to ban selling cigarettes to people who are under the age of 100. And they've actually said, this is the way we're going to do it. In New Zealand, we've had this goal, you know, we're more than halfway there since 2011. But there's never really been a clear strategy or plan on how to do it. So, you know, I think there's an intention, there's a goal here, but we need to be much more assertive about it, much like Hawaii is doing.
Are there any problems that can be associated with a sort of outright sudden ban like this? I mean, it seems 2024, I mean, I know their limit's already 21, which is a bit older than we have here, but 2024 is not far away to suddenly say no one's allowed to buy cigarettes.
Yeah, you know, there's always issues when you take an approach that's totally about prohibition. However, and I think the Hawaiian legislator is recognising this, in the last sort of 5 years in particular, there's been a massive increase in much, much safer alternatives to the cigarettes to help people manage their nicotine withdrawal, you know, be it if they're quitting smoking or when they can't smoke. So particularly in New Zealand as well, the huge rise in e-cigarettes and vaping and non-combustible nicotine products has been massive. I mean, it's estimated as, you know, up to 200,000 New Zealanders are using these products now. So I think what's really different now to 5 years ago, especially 10 years ago, is actually we're not just cutting off the supply to people, but actually recognising there are much, much safer alternatives that people can use, much like a cigarette, but with significantly less harm, significantly less chance of dying early as a consequence.
It seems now pretty impossible for New Zealand to reach that 2025 goal. What would be the first useful, actually assertive step? Do you think it's to focus more on alternatives, or should we at least raise our age to 21 or 22 or something like that? Is there a first step that we should be taking?
Well, I think the legislation's coming into the New Zealand Parliament this year that's about better regulating the safe alternatives, the vaping and the e-cigarettes, the oral tobacco products. I think really making sure that's a good piece of legislation is really, really important. Yet not cutting people off from using less harmful alternatives, helping people understand that those options are out there and available to them, and sanctioning their use through government quit smoking services, I think will be very disruptive to the smoked tobacco industry. I think New Zealand needs to make it much harder to sell the most harmful tobacco, the smoked tobacco. Controlling how the industry operates with those products in New Zealand, giving them a huge disadvantage against much safer products as well. I think it's going to be hard for us to get to smoke-free 25, you know, less than 5% smoking prevalence, especially for Māoris, still a third of people are smoking. But I do think it's achievable if we really focus on, you know, making the best use of things that aren't cigarettes to help people to quit, and making it much harder to use tobacco. With regards to increasing the age, I mean, the average age to start smoking in New Zealand is still in the sort of teenage years, sort of 15, 16 years old. One thing we've been incredibly successful is getting the smoking rate down for teenagers, down to less than 2% smoking now, probably one of the best rates anywhere in the world. So I think we've really got to focus on getting those established smokers, those who are 30 and above, off the cigarettes.
There's this argument, especially with alcohol and cannabis, that keeping it legal and sort of developing a framework around it is the best and safest way. Why, with cigarettes, do people often just talk about prohibition?
Well, I think we've got to break it down a bit, because when you're talking about alcohol, for example, you're talking about the alcohol. You're not talking about banning beer or wine or, you know, whatever the alcohol comes in. And with cigarettes, it's not about cigarettes. It's about actually understanding nicotine as the drug, right? And it's the nicotine that gets people addicted. And the cigarette is the most efficient, most dangerous way to get nicotine into the body. So it's not about banning nicotine. It's about providing safer ways to get that nicotine. So harm reduction, which is a well-established thing in tobacco, in alcohol and drug policy. So it's not a complete, it's not a ban on nicotine, but it's around liberalisation and much easier access to the much, much safer forms of nicotine, whilst having much, much harsher regulations on the most dangerous forms, which is the cigarette. And at the moment in New Zealand, we've got it the wrong way around. It's much, much easier to go out and buy a packet of cigarettes than it is to go out and buy a packet of nicotine gum or lozenges or even an e-cigarette. So, you know, we've got this topsy-turvy situation, which I, you know, I think remedying that would make a huge difference in getting to smoke-free 2025.
We had a call in a bit earlier from someone saying you can't really legislate against your own personal home. You shouldn't be able to say people can't smoke on their own property or on their own house. Rental may be different, but not in your own home. I think that's possibly a fair enough point. That was Ben Udan from ASH talking about New Zealand's goal to become smoke-free and whether it's actually going to happen.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Lisa, what have you got?
This is the international segment. I had planned to talk about a couple of things, but I guess I'll just stick to Venezuela, which I talked about last week, actually. It turns out lots of things happen in this ongoing political crisis, so I thought I'd just do a little report with the latest developments, maybe just a tiny little summary for those of you listeners who don't really know much about this complex situation. Basically, Venezuela's been going through an economic, social and political crisis, which culminated a month ago in the leader of the National Assembly at the parliament, who's member of the opposition, Juan Guaido, to proclaim himself as the new president of Venezuela, or interim president of Venezuela. And he's challenging the leadership of Nicolas Maduro, who's the current president, who took over the country in 2013 after Hugo Chavez passed away. And he was re-elected in May of 2018, but there are talks, I suppose, more so than reports, of irregularities. And so a lot of organisations and nations have decided to not support Maduro ever since. And so that culminated in Juan Guaido deciding that he, basically he believes that as the president of the National Assembly, the Constitution gives him the right to proclaim himself interim president if there are irregularities with the current president. So that's the legal text that he's using to be where he's at the moment. That has also has to be correlated with the economic crisis that the country is going through. There's been in the past, I'd say 10 years, massive rise in the prices of basic need goods, and the inflation is reaching new heights, and the poverty is really deepening, and so that has caused millions of people to exile from the country, and mass protests as well on the streets. So what happens next? After Juan Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president, some countries were very quick to recognize him as the official president of Venezuela. We're talking the United States, Canada, Australia, and quite a few Latin American countries like Argentina, Brazil, or Colombia. And then there were other countries like mainly in Europe, actually, that were quite cautious, a bit more cautious. They decided to send an ultimatum to Maduro first, so in the form of a deadline for new elections, a deadline that actually ended on Sunday night. And New Zealand had some sort of a similar position, no ultimatum, but definitely calling for three elections in Venezuela and not recognizing anyone as the president, I suppose. And then you had countries like China and Russia who are still backing Maduro, and another group that is still seemingly backing him is the Venezuelan military, which I'll talk about it in a minute, is actually quite important. So what has happened in the past week? Well, there's been massive protests again in the streets of Caracas. On Saturday, Maduro celebrated the 20th anniversary of his predecessor, so Hugo Chavez, taking power. And it was attended by a large crowd, which I guess shows that Maduro retains quite a consistent following. But on the other side, Juan Guaido talked at an opposition rally that gathered tens of thousands of people. And he was trying to get the civil and military officials to back him, and that is an important point because, like I said, the military is still apparently very much in favour of Maduro, but are they really? Because, again, some development this week with what was thought to be unconditional support for Maduro crumbling a little bit ahead of the protest. There's a high-ranking Air Force official that spoke in favour of the opposition in Guaido. And so Guaido also said that he was having secret meetings with the military to try and win their support. So it's not necessarily looking as solid as it might have thought it might have been thought to be, and it is quite an important point because it seems unlikely Maduro was actually stepped down unless he loses the support of the military. So long as he's got the support of the military, he's quite untouchable. Apart from, I suppose, military interventions from outside of Venezuela. But so long as he retains the power over the military in his own country, then he is kind of safe. So if he starts losing the support of the military, then it will start looking quite bad for him. And that could be cause for him stepping down. In terms of other support that he's got, or more so that he's lost, like I said, there was an ultimatum from European countries to hold new elections, and he rejected it, saying that he doesn't care what Europe wants and that he was denouncing a form of imperialism. And so he offered to hold parliamentary elections instead, maybe in an attempt to see his rival kicked out of his role as National Assembly's president, but obviously insisted that no presidential elections were on the cards before 2024. So the deadline ended on Sunday, and with no positive response from Maduro, a large group of European countries are expressing their recognition of Juan Guaido as interim president of Venezuela. We're talking France, Spain, the UK, Germany, and quite a few other European countries. Final point I wanted to make, other development, it's on the humanitarian front. Aid is currently being sent over to Venezuela from a few countries. So Juan Guaido has said that he's planning on setting up collection centres in neighbouring countries because he can't actually do it on the Venezuelan soil because he has no real power over there. So he's setting up three collection points around the border. And the United States is organising to send food parcels, quite a few of them. And there's also a lot of money being pledged to be sent. Canada has promised to contribute to up to $43 million Canadian dollars in aid, and Germany's talking about €6 million. So that is something that is probably going to keep coming, I think. More money to be promised, and we'll see where that takes us.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Sorry we had to kind of rush through that. That's okay. We were just yarning too much, weren't we, earlier?
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was The Wire.
That was The Wire for Tuesday, February the 5th. Thank you all for tuning in and sending us in your feedback. We all really appreciate it. On the show today, we had Graham Ball, Aaron Marshall, Mary Margaret Slack, and Ben Udan. Liv and Lisa, thank you, of course. And a huge thank you to our news director, Lillian Handley. Coming up next on 95BFM, it's The Wonderful with Jin. We'll see you back next week.
A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.